This is Currently Off Air, and in this transmission, you'll be hearing words and music from the late, the great, Bobby Wellens.
My name, official name, is Robert Cool, C-O-U-L-L, Wellens, and it's Bobby Wellens to the trade. And I am a working, well, what's laughingly called, a working jazz musician. I play the tenor saxophone, and I have been doing since the age of 19.
In 2012, Brighton film director Gary Barber made Dreams Are Free, a documentary on Bobby's life and career. The following interviews were recorded for the film. Born in Scotland in 1936, Bobby takes up the story.
My mother was a singer, professional singer and dancer. My father was from this Jewish family who had immigrated from Minsk in Russia, and they were living in the south side of Glasgow. He was pretty well self-taught, and then, of course, in the time of the Depression in the 30s, he was out on the streets busking, playing tunes. Saxophone, this is, of course, the alto saxophone. How they met was, in the film theatres, they would have a live big band show where my mother ended up as the singer and my father was the lead alto and arranger. When that came to an end, they decided to then go on the stage as a double act. My father by this time played a bit of guitar and musical saw, and he was basically a saxophonist, and of course jazz was a thing. And when he came out of the army after the Second World War, he bought a radiogram and he bought the collection with it, and the collection was right back from King Oliver, Jimmy Lunceford, right through Louis Armstrong. This collection was an amazing collection. Coleman Hawkins, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman. My father's one of these guys. He'd come in from work and say, listen to this. He said, this is just incredible. And it was Parker and Diz playing Now's the Time one side and Billy's Bounce on the other side. And we sat there and we were absolutely thrilled to bits. Into the RAF to learn the clarinet, and I was there for about a year and a half or so. The main reason for going into the School of Music was to learn the clarinet properly, and they had the wind band, the School of Music wind band. But what happened there was, and the interest in jazz, of course, playing the alto saxophone, was I switched to tenor then. I met this guy called Beverly Ingemels, who was much older than me. Bev had been there, gone into one of the regional bands and was about to be demobbed, so to speak. And he instructed me on improvisation. I was fascinated the way he played. And he described to me, he said, well, what he did was take a key and you'd say, right, this is the key of G for the saxophone. And you'd think about the blues. You'd think about the sequence, what it sounds like. You'd think of a phrase and you would work out the fingering of that phrase. Then you go back to your tenor saxophone and you play it because you've worked it out in your mind. And he was the first guy to indicate that you can practice in your head if you can hear what's going on.
the 1950s, at the invitation of trumpeter Kenny Wheeler, Bobby had begun working as a professional saxophonist.
I started gigging in London, but then I suddenly got a gig with the big bands, because I caught the last 3 years of the big band era. And that was fantastic. That was like the foundation, the experience and everything else. And it went on from there, where I began to meet all the other musicians who were passionate about improvisation.
I loved songs, I loved singers, I loved lyrics, but I loved jazz. It taught me basics of harmony. It taught me the most important thing was you had to have a certain discipline to get some kind of fun out of what you're doing. But you first of all had to put the work in and get the discipline going if you wanted to improvise.
That was Bobby's first recorded solo on the Buddy Featherstoner Quintet's Knock Yourself Out from 1956. And in 1958...
we went to America with Vic Lewis. The excitement was unbelievable. We were in, I think it was 48th Street. It's a hotel where artists were in transit. And across the road was this fantastic little eating place where you could get chili for $1.50. I'm looking out the window across at the hotel door. This is this tall figure with the raincoat and the pork pie hat. And when he turned round, I thought, oh, it's Lester Young. Foot to the side, across the road. Excuse me, it's a kind of high-pitched voice, Lester. Oh, yeah, can I buy you a drink? He said, oh, yeah, that would be nice. So we went into the hotel bar. And as the band were coming and going, they're looking in the bar to see if anybody's there, and they suddenly spot me sitting with Lester Young. Dickie McPherson, the trumpet player, had said to me, I always take Bob Brookmeyer a bottle of scotch. I said, Bob Brookmeyer? We're going to Greenwich Village to see Bob and say hello and all. I couldn't believe it. This was, you know, Bob Brookmeyer, one of the idols. You have this vision in your mind that all these great American jazz improvisers live in these ivory towers. And they come out of their ivory towers and they go into the city and they do Birdland and then back to their ivory towers, you see. So I said, well, where are you living in Greenwich Village? So in we go, one room, bedsit, with this sort of dull lighting and a little desk where there is manuscript, of course, and there's manuscript all over the place. And a valve trombone on the bed. And he said, oh, it's great to see you. Oh, hi, nice to meet you, Bobby. And this and that. Well, of course, you're absolutely... you're too excited to take anything in. You can't focus properly. And he said, now, you must forgive me. I've got a recording session tomorrow with a 20-piece band. And I've got to finish off. I won't be long. If you just bear with me, pour yourself a drink and... So I'm sitting and he's there at the desk and I'm watching him writing this arrangement. And it was as if he was writing a letter. ¶¶
That was Bob Brookmeyer and Stan Getz with A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square.
The upshot of that was, he said, are you guys working tomorrow night? We said, no. He said, well, tomorrow night we're all going to Warren Marsh's apartment. We're using the apartment for an all-night play.
Hey, what's with the party, huh? Where's the action?
And we arrived, you can imagine, very bohemian, and people sitting about, and I suppose they were smoking dope, which I knew nothing about at the time. It's Zoot Sims, Jerry Mulligan, Mose Allison on piano, Monty Budwig on bass. Zoot was absolutely wrecked, and he wouldn't stop playing, even when somebody else was their turn to solo, so to speak. So during a lull, Jerry Mulligan places his hand on Zoot's shoulder, and he said, for sake, Zoot, give us a chance. Zoot went, snarl, snarl. So they all wandered off into the kitchen and left him to his own devices. At this point, he suddenly realises that there's all these people sitting about on this floor, and he's looked at me, and he said, who are you? You know, and I said, we're Vic Lewis Band. Oh, yeah, I heard you guys were around. He looked at all of us, and he said, I don't need no fucking rhythm section anyway. And they went, and they went into this blues. Duncan Lamont turned to me halfway through and he said, he's right, he doesn't need a rhythm section at all. And of course, by this time, they're all starting to, ooh, this sounds rather nice, you know, and coming out and joining in because he's got it going.
That was Zoot Sims, Just Blues.
On the way back on the plane, Duncan Lamont said, can you believe that? These are the greatest players in the world, all meeting for an all-night play, never mind gigs and money and everything else. We've got to find a place to do this. And we found the Nucleus in Denman Street. And it so happened that the guy who was running the Nucleus then was a bit of a drummer. We said, we're looking for a place where we can all get together and meet and play some jazz music. And it was obviously the right time because within 2 weeks, everybody who was anybody of the night packed into this place. And of course, the licensing laws were extremely strict. No booze, one loud booze, coffee, really. All the guys who were donning at the nightclubs, the ladies of the night, everything. I mean, it was absolutely fantastic. That went on for several years. But during that time, naturally, the word got round to our idols. My idol was Ronnie Scott, and Vic Feldman, Tony Crombie, and Ronnie's come down because he wants to come and have a blow with the young team, you see. And the next thing is, Crombie's come down, and we're having a play, and we're like, oh.
This is Tony Crombie's Jazz Incorporated with Stan Tracy's composition, little old Pottsville.
Tony just phoned me up and he said, I'm starting a little band and I want you to be in the band. And Stan was in the band. Now, I'd heard of Stan because he was with Heath, Ted Heath's band then, but I didn't know him, but I knew him by reputation. And from the word go, I was in seventh heaven when he accompanied me on the piano, because it kind of opened doors for me to investigate.
By the early 1960s, Bobby Welin started regularly gigging with Stan Tracy. One venture was the New Departures Jazz Poetry Septet, accompanying poets Pete Brown and Michael Horowitz. Here's an excerpt from a 1962 live recording of Blues for the Hitchhiking Dead.
Fast ribs of vast organs vibrating, faster, faster stars dripping, pots of blocks in glacier deltas, bouncing glass marbles, bracing, breaking, clattering cliffs, shattering tiled floors, rubbing precipices over galvanized gullies, splintering agate in smithereens, cracking open slits in soup tureens. Soup oozes out to freeze on pedestals of flaming tongues of hemp and hemp men, all stars shimmering, hemp, hemp, battering, booming, his mirror crackling, monstrous machine of heavy guttural, nasal and final stampeding, slates dangling keyrings on the all-consuming belt of rhythm, atom mathematicking over, causing to squirm, jump and shout, turn over, rush to the surface. Blood springs after spare ribs shaken in shim, sham, she wobbles, fragments, that string shun hash, talk some trash this morning, send, rend, bend. Sometimes his music makes for a kind of sea.
Bobby Wellens often stood in for Ronnie Scott as part of the club's in-house band.
The scene was brilliant because Ronnie was a compulsive gambler, and across the road was Italian Jocks. And I think Jock worked for Albert Dimes, who was a renowned character. An Italian Jock was from Glasgow, and he had that broken Scots-Italian accent. What happened was, if Ronnie was on a roll, Pete King would ring me and say, can you do the quartet tonight? Well, of course, Stan and I had already established the Crombie thing. And Stan used to phone up and say, has Pete phoned you to do the... Yes, I'm doing it tonight. Oh, right. And then two or three nights I'd do for Ronnie. And the first time it happened, Pete says, well, you have to go across the road and knock on the door and the slot will open. And the guy say, yeah, and say, I'm here to get paid by Ronnie Scott for doing a gig across the road. So when the door opened, there was Jock, you see. Hello, son, how are you doing? Ah, Ronnie's spoken about you. Ah, I know, but... And he had the braces. He was the absolute epitome.
Under Milk Wood by Dylan Thomas.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now.
Thank you.
Stan was very interested in poetry, and Stan had been listening to the reel-to-reel of Under Milk Wood, and he decided to do the suite. Patrick Garland, who was a wonderful producer, had invited Stan and I to a four-person version of Under Milk Wood, theatrical version, using the music from the album. And they played it, a track at the interval as well. And it was at that moment, listening to these tracks, we sort of looked at each other like, hey, this is quite good, really. As far as I was concerned, at that time it was breaking ground through his way of playing and his way of soloing as well. He's so unselfish with accompanying, but Sonny Rollins loved him, the way he played. To this day, the music of the suite is just absolute genius as far as I'm concerned. He's done greater things, arrangements, and suites, and compositions and everything else, but of course Milk Wood sticks.
This is Stan Tracy, briefly, on his relationship with Bobby.
Yeah, he has a beautiful sound. Well, there is an empathy, but I don't want to analyse it in any way, because you know, I think once you start doing that, it sort of crumbles. So I'm just glad it's there.
When you work with Stan, there's a lot of humour and mischief. Yes, there's poignancy and romanticism and all the moods. I like the moods. I like the different moods that one can create. And if you get yourself surrounded, if you're fortunate enough to be able to play with the guys who accomplish these things and feel the same way, then it can't be any better than that, as far as I'm concerned. We'll be right back. Alice and Bible Black, in retrospect, knowing the man that I was then, or the boy that I was then, there's a poignancy, there's something in there that I desperately am trying to express of how lost I am, if you like, totally lost, and I'm not happy, and I know that I've got into a very dangerous situation. I'm well aware that I'm in a very dangerous position. Walking very dangerous corridors when you're involved with drugs like that. And there's an element of sadness to the whole thing. I just feel that when I hear myself playing it. I like it, but I can hear this boy and I think, oh, you poor boy, you know. That's what I think at times, because it's not really me, you know, but it was me then. I was kind of lost. It was a bad time.
Sleeping in the streets in the slow, deep, salt and silent, black, bandaged night. Only you can see in the blinded bedrooms the combs and petticoats over the chairs, the jugs and basins, the glasses of teeth, thou shalt not on the wall, and the yellowing dicky bird watching pictures of the dead. Only you can hear and see behind the eyes of the sleepers the movements and countries and mazes and colours and dismays and rainbows and tunes and wishes and fright and fall and despairs. And big seas of their dreams. From where you are, you can hear their dreams.
I think the original recording of Under Milkwood, we seemed to have a magic moment, it would seem to me. But there have been subsequent recordings when we did Alice in Jazzland with the big band. That was a good one.
In the late 1960s, Spike Wells was a drummer for tenor saxophonist Tubby Hayes.
It all got a bit difficult at the end of the 60s, you know, because jazz had been rather eclipsed. I suppose the Beatles started it, really, and people became very interested in British pop music, and jazz took a bit of a back seat, and it was very difficult to get work. I know a lot of the people like Stan and Tubby and everything in about early 70s, they just, you know, felt that they weren't getting the recognition that they had before, and, you know, it was a very difficult time.
I had my 10 years of in the wilderness as someone, because they're very diplomatic when they put your sort of background on sleeve notes and said due to ill health, you know. But it was a serious narcotic addiction which nearly finished me off altogether. Were perfectly capable of playing. It didn't affect our standard of playing. We were obviously on top of situation playing-wise. And I can't speak personally for Stan, but we were not well. The myth about heroin came from Charlie Parker, that people thought this is what made him play like he played. Nothing to do with that. Nothing to do with that. It doesn't do anything to enhance anything, but what it does enhance is your outlook on life. It takes you into a world where you think all is not only well, but it's going to continue to be well forever. That's the narcotic. And there is no doubt about it. That when you're into using heroin, there's a certain feeling, but it's very short-lived, that feeling, because you soon discover
that in order to keep regaining that certain feeling, you have to keep using the drug. In other words, when you're hooked, you're actually chasing the drug to function, and you don't particularly get that wonderful feeling that you first got, like most things in life.
That was Sweet Used to Be from the Stan Tracy Quartet's LP With Love from Jazz, recorded in 1967. This is Isabel Wellens on Bobby's move down to Bognor Regis on the south coast of England.
I didn't know anything about drugs, anything at all, weren't a clue. I didn't even drink hardly, you know. I'd met him in the 65. By April, we got married. And he wasn't so bad then, because I didn't know anything about it. I think he tried to come off, and it was like a nightmare. As we always said, it wasn't him. You know what I mean? It wasn't Bobby. I said, but why on earth would you want to take anything like that? He just said, a few musicians did, and so he tried it. And I think Bobby's the type that he gets hooked easy on things.
65 to 75 was the 10-year addiction. We got married, and she decided that we should live down here because this was on Mum and Dad's house. And I think the initial idea was that get me out of the London environment and see if I could somehow break it completely. And so we came down here, and of course it didn't work.
I wouldn't wish it on anybody to. When I see these people taking drugs, I think, you're mad. Oh, I mean, I spent my whole early life looking for drugs, searching for drugs. I threw them in the bin. If I found anything, it'd go berserk.
I'd stopped playing. I'd sold the saxophone to the dealer. I was totally gone, totally sick. And all I wanted was just my drugs. Couldn't care less what was going on.
After many years struggling with addiction, Bobby regained his health and returned to playing.
This would be coming up to my 40th year, 1975. Adrian Kendon approached me to start playing again. Now, unbeknownst to me, Spike was a fan. That's how we started getting back into playing in Spike and drums.
Adrian Kendon had started a Brighton jazz club in Kemp Town, and he used to ring me up and say, do you want to come down and play? And one night he rang up and said, do you want to come down and play? We've got Bobby Wellens coming. I thought, oh, wow, Bobby Wellens? God, I remember him. So I came down and we had a wonderful evening, and we had Pete Jacobson on piano, the blind pianist Pete Jacobson, a really talented guy, and we sort of decided to form a quartet more or less on the spot, and that was the first Bobby Wellens quartet that I played regularly with, Pete Jacobson on piano and Adrian Kendon on bass, and we made a couple of records, stayed together for several years.
Well, this was, of course, me back playing again and really realising how much I'd missed playing.
Bobby was writing quite a lot of material. I'm just looking at the original LPs here that we did in those days. The first one, Jubilation, well, they were all Bobby Wellens originals. And then Dreams Are Free, Love Dance, Aura. They're all Bobby Wellens originals.
It was wonderful with Spike. He was driving us along and things. Spike had this, he's very original. You know, where you'd maybe be playing a medium tempo thing and he'd suddenly speed it up and bring it back again to him. No, I'd never had anybody do that. And we, of course, accommodated all that. And as Spike said, I was a wee bit more avant-garde in those days than what I am now, I suppose, I'm sort of falling back on the old standards. There, and Pete, of course, Pete Jacobson, was an absolute mega talent, you know, Pete being blind, but he had perfect pitch, and he just was an absolute superlative keyboard player, piano player.
Working again, Bobby came into contact with more jazz greats, including Dizzy Gillespie.
We were doing a thing at Ronnie's, Dizzy was on and we were opposite. I had a thing called Dreams Are Free, and it sort of goes dum do ding dum do ding dum do ding dum. So when I came off, he said to me, African, eh? I said, no, Scottish. And he went, well, it sounds a bit African. No, it's not. Scottish. Oh, okay then. So after that, we used to meet at occasional soirees, and it became a sort of standing joke thing, sort of thing. It's still Scottish, is it, that composition? I said, very much so. So I was lying in bed about 3 a.m, and the phone went, and the voice said, John Burks Gillespie here, which threw me completely. John Burks Gillespie? Who's that?
I've just been on 48th Street watching a Scottish parade with pipers and drums. You are right, it was a good Scottish composition.
And I thought, that's Dizzy, you see. And I said, do you know what time it is? He said,
yeah, I know it's 3 o'clock in the morning now, isn't it?
In the late 1970s, Bobby Wellens collaborated with trombonist and arranger for Charles Mingus, Jimmy Nepper.
Well, Jimmy had got quite big because of the Mingus band. Now, Jimmy was really the catalyst for that band. He got the writing going and got everything happening. Mingus was very dependent on Jimmy.
Thank you.
on the tour. He caught a bit of a cold. I think we were in Arbroath or somewhere like that. And I said, by the way, we're in the area where they make this Glenmorangie whiskey. It's out of this world, by the way, Jim, you know. Oh, really? I said, yeah, might help your cold if you're one of them. So this is the hotel. He had one of them. He said, say, it's making me feel pretty good. It is pretty good medicine, Bobby. So by 3:30 in the morning, the little night porter, the elderly night porter, comes in. The manager says, I've to lock the drinks cabinet and you've all to go to your bed. So we'd got into it with the Glenmorangie, you see. But the next morning, he said, I feel great. You were right. I feel absolutely great. The cold's gone. We had a wonderful tour with Jimmy. He was, hey, boy, you could learn from him. Oh, what a player. One of the best ones was Charlie Watts' band, you know, the massive Charlie Watts venture, 86, 87. That was amazing. It was a lovely time. That tour with Charlie was fantastic.
Commissioned by South Eastern Arts to write a suite of music, which, although we had total flexibility, they preferred something which was pertaining to the south coast of England, where I live. So I decided I would do a suite on the endangered species of birds. The endangered species.
Was taken from the first movement of Birds of Brazil by Bobby Wellens. In 2006, Bobby Wellens and Stan Tracy revisited Starless and Bible Black in a collaboration with vocalist Norma Winston on a version of Robert Frost's poem, My November Guest.
Sky. sky. The beauty she so truly sees, she thinks I have no eyes for these, and vexes me for reasons why.
Bobby Welland's regular quartets was with Spike Wells on drums, Andy Kleindert on bass, and Mark Edwards on piano. Here they are, with Don Weller on additional saxophone on a version of Gershwin's My Man's Gone Now.
Just the individual who's making the sound, it's the people that you're working with or making music with who are also making things work for each other, which make you sound good too. It's very important, because in the past era with Tubby's big band, the rhythm section were the workhorse. Tubby was the star. But of course, I never ever believed in that. Anybody who wants to be the star, they're making a big mistake, because good music won't come out of that. Tubby was an exceptional player and a cracker. You know, I love his playing and all, but the rhythm section was just there for Tubby. It doesn't work like that, I don't think. I think what makes good music is that everybody else has got to have their say musically, and it can't be all just me, me, me. It's got to be them as well. For instance, when I work with Mark Edwards and Spike and Andy Kleindert, it's a wonderful quartet, but it's only a wonderful quartet because of Mark and Spike and Andy and me.
Bobby Welland's last LP and tour was a collaboration with the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra, revisiting his 1961 composition, Culloden Moor. Here's the orchestra's founder and director, saxophonist, Tommy Smith.
I've been a fan of Bobby since I was a kid, 12 years old or so. And since I'm the artistic director of the band, I have to think of different projects to do. So I phoned him up and asked him if he'd be interested, and he had this material for the Culloden Suite. We commissioned a whole bunch of composers to arrange his music, and here we are.
I have to mention the Scottish concerts. Mind you, I was a bundle of nerves, but I still, they were very enjoyable. I really did enjoy them. They were good.
I think that he is probably the most creative improviser on the tenor saxophone that this country has ever produced. And he's got something in his playing which is unique, which I haven't heard a trace of in anybody else. I don't know where he gets it from, but it's completely distinctive. And there's no question of imitating American players or anything, which most saxophonists inevitably do. You just don't hear that in Bobby. It all seems to be him, you know, and I think that's what he'll be remembered for. Complete originality and beauty, real beauty in his playing.
After a lifetime of performance, Bobby Wellens died in October 2016. His funeral included poetry readings from his New Departures colleagues, Michael Horowitz and Pete Brown, tributes from family and friends, and a performance by Don Weller. The service was led by Father Spike Wells. Bobby Wellens leaves behind his words and his music. Thanks, Bobby. Many thanks to Gary Barber, director of the documentary on Bobby Wellens' life and music, Dreams Are Free. I've posted up links to extracts from the film on our website, currentlyoffair.com, where you can also find a playlist of all the tracks in this transmission, subscribe to the podcast, and listen again to previous shows.